Okay, then. So where are we up to? Okay, then. So let's take a look on Chavav Amud Aleph. We'll learn today a little bit about Perek Shviis. And our main challenge is going to be to try to understand Rabbi Shimon. So let's just review what Rabbi Shimon has to say. So that'll give us a framework, a background into what we want to study today. So the Mishnah on Daf Chav Dalet Amud Beis says the following. Amar Rabbi Shimon B'tchila, that is originally at the time of this Gzera in which the Chacham enacted a Psul Eidus called Sochre Shviis, those who were selling Perek Shviis, because the Torah says in the Parsha Shviis at the end of Vayikra, it says Vaysa Shabbos Ha'aretz Lachem Li'achla. And the Gemara in Avodah Zarah darshins la'achla v'lo l'schara, that the pears of Shviis are meant to be eaten, and the owner of the land has to open his field and allow the poor people to come in and take these pears of Shviis, but he's not allowed to harvest the field, take the pears, and sell them on the market. That would be a violation of l'schara. But for the love of money, people would violate this Isur. They took the Perek Shviis, they made schor out of it. They made a business. They sold it on the market. And that would be a violation of the Torah law. And therefore, the Chachamim are going to passel them for Avis, because if they're willing to violate the Torah for the love of money, then they'll probably be willing to perjure themselves in a testimony for the sake of money if somebody pays them off. So again, all the psulim in the Mishnah here on Daf Chav Dalet Amud Beis, each one of them is the Rabbanon, it's not the Oraisa. And again, we're going to have to try to figure out why the Sofrei Shviis, who are violating an Issa d'Oraisa of Schora, why they're not possible with the Oraisa. That's a question we'll get to in Mirz Hashem later on today. But the language of Shimon is very complex. He says, B'tchila, initially, they had one name. The Chachamim gave a certain name, like they described this category of people who are Sochrei Shviis, and they called them Osvei Shviis, meaning that they were collectors of Shviis. These were people who went into the fields and they gathered together the fruits of Shviis, and they were Posseliators. But then, at some point later on, they changed the name of these individuals. And those who fit this category of people who are doing merchandise and selling Perek Shviis were no longer called Osvei Shviis, but then they were called Sochrei Shviis. Now what happened in between? Misha Rabu Ha'anosim. Now we don't know exactly what the Anosim is all about. Some sort of compelling situation. And our Gemara today, in Mirz Hashem, will try to solve this riddle. What is this Rabu Ha'anosim? And if we figure out what Rabu Anosim is, then maybe we'll understand why they changed the name of this category, of this membership club, from Osvei Shviis to Sochrei Shviis. So that's what we want to look at today. So we're on Daf Chavav Amud Aleph, and we are four lines down from the top, or if you want to call it five lines down from the top, Amar Rabbi Shimon. So after quoting the Mishnah, the Gemara says, "My Ka'amar." And my Ka'amar can be understood as two different questions, and they're both correct. Number one is, how could he start by calling them Osvei Shviis and then change their name to Sochrei Shviis? And secondly, what was this Misha Rabu Anosim here in the middle? What exactly went on and what changed the situation so that the Psul now shifted from Osvei Shviis to Sochrei Shviis? So Amar Rabbi Yehuda Hachi Ka'amar. B'tchila Hayu Omrim Osvei Shviis Ksherim. So Rabbi Yehuda Shita, again, the Gemara is going to change it later on, but according to Rabbi Yehuda, at the first stage, which is called in the language of Rav Shimon B'tchila, it doesn't mean B'tchila Sapsul. It doesn't mean that at that point there were already, the Chacham had already enacted a psul called Osvei Shvius, but rather, initially, since the people were guilty of being Osvei Shvius, they were Ksherim Yedis. Now, the word Osvei, as opposed to Sochrim, implies that you ate the fruits of the Shvius. Now, if you're eating the fruits of the Shvius, that's exactly what the Torah commands you to do. So what does it mean, B'tchila, they were called Osvei Shvius, and they were Kosher Yedis? And on this point, we have the insights of the Rishonim. Again, when I say the Rishonim, you have to look into Rashi, into Tosfos, into the Rabbeinu Yonah, and other Rishonim. Again, the flavor I can give you of all the Rishonim here, as far as Osvei Shvius is concerned, and why there might have been a Havamina that maybe they should be Pasul. And Rabbi Yehuda says, no, that's not what Rav Shim means when he says, Mitchila Yukar no so Osvei Shvius, but on the contrary, they were Ksherim. So the Mefarshim say that the Osvei Shvius went beyond the allotment that the Torah permitted them to take Shvius, Peiro Shvius. The Torah permitted you to take Peiro Shvius for the purpose of Achila, and the Torah commands us, Li Achla, that you should eat the Peiro Shvius. Unfortunately, you know, people get a little bit hungry, so to speak. I don't mean that literally, but they, you know, if they give the opportunity to collect these Peiro Shvius, you know, free of charge, so they start hoarding it. They start gathering it together way beyond what they need. And although they set themselves up in a situation where there no doubt would be surplus. Now, what happens if you have fruits and you don't need them because you've gathered together more fruits than what you can possibly consume? So then you have the possibility of making some profit on it. So imagine the Osvei Shvius filled up their bags and their baskets with produce, which was Kedusha Shvius. They ate most of it, but they filled up their bags way beyond the capacity of whatever they could eat. So what would they do? Instead of letting the fruit rot, they would sell it on the open market. So in effect, they did violate the Iser of Schora B'Peiro Shvius. They made a profit on this. But, and here I want to give you the language of the Yad Ramah, Mikomakom came a B'Shas Asif at the moment in time when they collected the Peiros. There was no clear-cut proof. Shame osvim kidei limkar. In other words, we don't know exactly why they took such a volume, an amazing volume of fruits. It could be they have family members, maybe they have cousins. They can have a party. They can invite the whole neighborhood. You know, they can invite all the aniyim in town, or maybe they'll sell it on the open market. But we cannot know clearly that they are going to sell the surplus Peiros of Shvius, and since there's no Ochacha, therefore lo paslu osam. Until the later stage, when it became absolutely crystal clear, obvious to everyone that they were Sochrim, that they were actually taking these extra fruits in order to sell them and pocket the profits. And at that point, it was clear that they violated the Isa of the Ochla v'lo l'schora, and they were called Sochre Shvius. And that's when the Chachamim decided to passel them. This is the way the Yad Ramah understands Rabbi Yehuda's interpretation of Rabbi Shimon. Now, what happened in stage two? So we said that according to Yad Ramah, what happened in stage two, it became obvious that they were Sochrei Shvius. Mishav Rabu, what happened in between? Again, the language of Rabbi Shimon, as we saw in the Mishnah Chav Dalit, was Mishav Rabu ha'anosim, which sounds like people compelled them. Onus means when you do something under duress. I mean, it doesn't seem to be appropriate here that there was some duress here or some outside external force that compel them to all of a sudden become open and shut, clear-cut marketers of Peiro Shvius. until now, at stage one, it was not hochach, there was no clear indication that they would take the surplus shvius and sell it. What happened at stage two? It became obvious, says the Yad Rama, that they were sochrei shvius, and that's when the Chacham stood up and they passed them. Again, we have to always ask the question why the Torah wouldn't passel them if they violated the Doraisa of sochrei shvius. Says Rabbi Yehuda, what happened in between stage one and stage two? Misharavu mamtzie mos lanir. This is very fascinating. The landowners realized that they could make a profit here on the deal. They didn't want to violate the iser of schora, because if they would have personally gathered and harvested their produce in order to market it and sell it on the open market, that would be an open, glaring violation of the Torah law. So they did it in a roundabout way. What they did is, they commissioned the Aniyim, they told the Aniyim, we'll pay you a certain amount of money, and you go ahead and collect the payroll shvius. And that's what the Gemara says here, Misharobu mamtzie mos laniyim. Mamtzi means they presented mos to the Aniyim, and it was a certain kind of a commission fee. The Ozli Aniyim, the Aniyim went, the Osvulahu, and they went in and they collected the Peros Shvius. Again, it doesn't look obvious to the naked eye that they are violating the Issur Schora, because these are Aniyim who are allowed to collect Peros Shvius, and that's exactly what they're doing. But then it says Umaisu. Umaisu means that they brought the fruits back to the owner of the field. So now, what the Aniyim are doing is, although on the face of it, it looks like they're just simply collecting the Perishvias, they're not making profit on the Perishvias, but in fact they are making profit on the Perishvias. What profit are they making?
Wages.
Correct, the payoff that they get from the landowner to commission them to go ahead and collect the Perishvias. Now there's a Tosus here, Dibra Maschil Elu, just 1 second. Oh no, I'm sorry. The Tosfos Dibur Maschil Elu, my mistake, is not here. It's elsewhere, Masechta Rosh Hashanah. He says that the reason why there's no Psul Doraisa here is because the Aniyim themselves never actually went out to the market to sell the Peros Shvius. What they did was they were malakit the Peros Shvius as, so to speak, shluchim of those who would pay them off. But they actually didn't go out to the market to sell the Peros Shvius. So although they made a profit because they were paid off to collect the Peros Shvius, in a way that would look on the outside as if there was no violation, so they were pocketing money, and that in effect is schora, but it's not the schora doraisa that the Torah prohibited. The schora doraisa means that you go into the field, you collect the fruits of shvius, and then you package it, and you market it, and you collect the profits. That they didn't do. So therefore, those osvei shvius now became sochrei shvius. Now, what does it mean they became sochrei shvius? Not that they would sell the Paris on the open market, that glaring of a violation they wouldn't have the chutzpah to do, but rather they would make a profit for their collecting of the Paris shvius, which they brought back to the shluchim who sent them to do so. Is chazru lomar, the Gemara says, echad zevi echad zev psulim. Now the Gemara says we're not going to make any distinction between those who collect these vast volumes of Peros Shvius and those who actually go out to the market and sell them. Even the Osvei Shvius are now going to be Posel Yedus, because we're going to consider them as Sochrei Shvius. Again, the Torah didn't consider them Sochrei Shvius, but the Chachamim say this is a kind of an indirect Schora that they get from the Peros Shvius. So I'll just read to you one line from the Tosfos Chachmei Anglia, and they say the following, that what Rabbi Shimon meant in the Mishnah, according to this presentation of Yehuda, is betchila they call them osvei shvius, and they were kosher liedus. But misharabu anasim. Now the word anasim means as kind of a psychological or financial pressure that was placed on the Osfei Shviyas, that instead of their going home with these vast volumes of Peros Shviyas in which they would decide what they could eat and what they could, and what was surplus, and they would sell it. Now they're in a position where they were given such a financially lucrative offer to take this money and go ahead and collect the Peros Shviyas on behalf of someone else. So they were called Sochrim, and they became Posel. And at that moment in time, the Mishnah, when it says the word Anasim, has in mind those who pressured them financially by offering them a wonderful service payment for their service of collecting the Shviyas. So the real Psul Doraisa would be those who actually sold the pair of Shviyas on the market. But the Chiddush of our Mishnah is that at some point in time, the Rabbanim said that even the Aniyim who are Osvei Shviyas, even they became Psul. Why? Because now it became obvious, it was well known, and this was commonplace, that the so-called Osvei Shviyas were not really genuinely interested in eating the pair of Shviyas. They were only doing so as a shliach to bring the pair of Shviyas back to those who would sell them, and the Aniyim themselves were paid off to do so. Kashu Bei B'nei Rachva. There's a group of scholars that are called B'nei Rachva. Rachva was a scholar, and his children were outstanding Amoraim. The Gemara tells us back in the beginning of the Masechta that their names was Eifa and Avimi. Anyway, they had a question and an objection to Rabbi Yehuda's interpretation of our Mishnah of Rabbi Shimon. Hi, is it possible that our Mishnah should use this ambiguous phrase Misharabu Hanasim? Hanasim sounds like somebody put a gun to your head. Usually when you find in the Mishnah the word ones, it refers to an absolute physical assault of a person where you threaten his life. Here, according to Rabbi Yehuda, the phrase Misharabu Anasim is referring to some sort of, as we said earlier, financial pressure, because they made an offer to the Aniyim to be Osvei Shviyas on their behalf, and they collapsed, you know, they count out because of this wonderfully attractive carrot, you know, this financial payment. But that's not called anasim. But rather, if the Mishnah wanted to convey the fact that now it was clear that there was a whole movement here to sell Peros Shviyas, and now the official sellers would commission the Aniyim and pay them off, then the proper or more appropriate language in the Mishnah to convey that message would have been Misharabu Atagrim, that there are so many people out there in the market today that are selling Peros Shviyas, it became such a rampant misdemeanor, that they started paying off the Osvei Shviyas. Because they, again, as we said before, would not glaringly go out themselves and lower themselves to collect the Peros Shviyas in order to package them and market them. Instead, they had the Aniyim do the dirty work of collecting the Shviyas. But this is all because of Misharabu Atagrim, because everyone was getting on board. You know, when you have a good deal in the market, all of a sudden somebody discovers it, and he's the first one to make a killing. But ultimately the word gets out, hey, this is a lucrative business, and everyone jumps on the board. So all of a sudden people realize that Peros Shviyas are making a good business on the marketplace. So that's called Misharabu Atagrim. Again, as we said before, they wouldn't lower themselves to personally collect the Peros Shviyas from their own fields. They let the Aniyim do the dirty work. They did the Asif. But the Meshalchim who sent them, they were doing this Schora. So that's called Tagrim or Sochrim. But don't call it Anasim. And based on this question, the Gemara is actually going to put Rabbi Yehuda on the back burners, reject Rabbi Yehuda, and offer a whole new twist to what Rabbi Shimon had in mind, what was going on mitchila, what was Misharabu Anasim, and why at the end they called them Sochrei Shviyas. Ella, says the Gemara, Betchila Hayu Omrim Echad Zevi Echad Zep Sulim. not the way you interpreted Rabbi Yehuda, that betchila they were ksherim because they didn't, you know, and they didn't in an obvious, recognizable way sell the perishvias. They just had some surplus, which at the end maybe they would sell. But rather they were psulim from the get-go. And what does it mean, echad zev echad zev? Whoever it was, whether it was the osef, whether it was those who collected the perishvias but they didn't need to eat them, or they collected much more than what they would need to eat, or the sochrim, the outright, you know, marketeers who would take the perishvias and market them, all of these were posuliedus. But at some point, misharabu anasim, the halach is going to change, and now everybody involved here in collecting shvias is going to become kosher. And that's Misharabu Anasim. There's some sort of compulsion that, or duress here, that forces people to collect the pair of shvias. And as a result of that duress, they would not be possible. So it's the exact opposite. According to Rabbi Yehuda's interpretation of Shem Mitchila, means they were kosher. And then Misharabu, they became possible. Now we're saying that initially they were possible, and they became kosher Misharabu Anasim. So what is Misharabu Anasim? Who is bludgeoning them? Who is compelling them with a gun to force them to collect the payroll shvias? My ninu Arnona. We never like Arnona. Arnona are taxes. And the king is taxing every single field because he expects the fruits of the field to be divided in a way in which he, the king, representing the Malchus, would collect a major percentage of the produce of the field. And the king would send out his shluchim, you know, these were the tax collectors, and they would compel the Jewish landowners to collect the payros, and the king couldn't care a hoot about shvias. The shvias was not on his radar screen, so that even during the shvias, the shluchei beis hamelech would represent the kingship and pressure the Jewish people to collect the payros and give to the king a certain percentage as a tax, and that's called arnona. And the Chachamim now were in a bind. They had to address the following halachic issue. On the one hand, we're not allowed to collect these perish shvias. I mean, the landowner himself is not allowed to harvest and hoard the perish shvias. On the other hand, what would be the repercussions if they didn't allow the Jewish landowners to collect the shvias, the perish shvias? The king would be very, very angry, maybe throw them into jail. Jail in those days for a Jew was a very dangerous situation. So the poskim, the chachamim of that generation, came to the following decision, that better to let the Jewish nation collect the perosh shvias and pay off the king his tax that he was demanding, than to suffer the consequences of observing the law of perosh shvias. Kidemachri is Rabbi Yanai. Rabbi Yanai came to his city and he told the Jewish landowners, Puku, go out, Ziru b'shvias, plant during shvias. Now, planting during shvias is an even more severe avera. The land has to lie fallow, v'shav sal aretz, Shabbos Lashem, and you don't do malach in the field. He went out and he announced, go out and do malach in the field and plant the field. As a result, you're going to harvest the produce of the field, and all this for the purpose of paying the king his mas, his set tax. And once it was allowed to do the avodah in the sada, it's chazru lomar, they said, osvim ksherim v'socharim psulim. They said the following, that those who would collect the perishvias were kosher, because this process of collecting perishvias was necessary in order to pay off the tax. But the Sochrim, those who took advantage of the situation, and they not only collected the fruits, harvesting them, giving the due to the king for his collection tax, but they also took the rest of the perishvias and they marketed it and made a profit, or they were psulim. But the original status of the Osvim, which we said were people who illegally took masses amount and volumes of perishvias, and they were posuliedus, that was now changed, that was reversed, so that Osvei Shvius would always be understood to be doing so because of the necessity of harvesting and therefore paying the tax. Now there are a whole bunch of questions here that we have to ask, and I'm going to go through some of these questions according to the various mefarshim. Let's begin with the Yad Ramah, as we always like to do, and the Yad Ramah says the following. He says the Osfim who would take more than their need, they were posel. In other words, according to the Yad Ramah, in the new formulation and explanation of Rabbi Shimon, b'tchila they were all poslim, they were all psulim, they were called osvei shvius, because apparently it became obvious that they were selling a certain percentage, if not most, of what they collected, because they didn't need for their families that amount of collection. So it became obvious. And at that point, once it was clear that the osvei shvius were involved in selling the extra shvius, the surplus shvius, they were possible. That was before this whole story with the Arnona. And then he says that what happened was poslu gam elu she'osim es ha'peros lebateim v'pei shaloya mafkirim sadoseim kidin el shomros al kishar shonim. He adds another element to the equation. He said that let's say there were no anim around and the landowners would go out to collect the fruits from their own land, and presumably when they collected these fruits and they took them into their homes, they were holding it on behalf of the anim. But the answer is no. These osvei shvius, the landowners themselves, would lock up their fields. You know, it was a gated community, and they wouldn't allow the anim to come in. So it became obvious that these osvei peros shvius were doing so not for the purpose of presenting the anim for presenting the peros for the achilas anim, but for their own personal purposes, and that was prohibited. And the Meiri says that even the anim who would collect the peros shvius for their own purposes, but nevertheless gam osvu litzorech hanoshim shenosel emos, they would also add a little bit to their asifa for those who would pay them off. So this was the original status or state of being of mitchila. Osvei shvius, three different subcategories of osvei shvius, were all posulyedas. It was either the aniyim who collected too much shvius, and obviously they were going to do schora with the pair of shvius, or it was the balabatim who, in situations where they didn't find the aniyim, would collect the pair of shvius and take them into their homes, but they wouldn't allow the aniyim to get access to their homes. Or, as the Meiri would say, it was the osvei shvius who were the aniyim who were paid off to take a little bit of peros shvius for the sake of the mishalchim. Okay, now we get to stage number two, misharabu hanosim, and the Gemara identifies that as the arnona. The Ravid says in Hilchos Shmita v'Yovel that if the Jewish people would not pay the tax to the king, the arnona, then first and foremost he would threaten to confiscate their property, their sada. The Rambam says that the king would command the field owners to take the produce and offer it to the chayalim, to the militiamen, who would need sustenance, and this would be their mizonos. And you don't know, according to the Rambam, whether the king threatened to confiscate the property and the real estate of the landowners. I'm not sure. It's not clear from the Rambam. But in any event, according to the Ravid, the king was so motivated to collect this tax that he would no doubt confiscate the property of any landowner who didn't offer to pay that tax. So it means that there's a financial danger here, that a person would lose his field if he didn't pay this tax during the Shvius year. So comes along Rav Shimon, and he says the following, Mitchila, these psulim were called osvei shvius, they were posel because they were selling peros shvius, or they weren't allowing the aniyim to get access to the shvius. But Misharabu Anasim Hikshiru Es HaOsfim, those who collected the Shvias and harvested the produce were Ksherim. And now we get to the main question that Rashi raises, Dibra Maschil Puku. Rashi asks, how could the Chachamim be Matir, the Iser Doraisa of Avodah B'Shvias, simply because of a Hefseid Mammon? The Torah says, B'chol Ma'odecha, then rather than violate an Iser Torah, a person has to be willing to give up the last penny of the shirt off his back. And here we're dealing with a clear-cut case of a violation of a Doraisa to do Avodah in the Karbana, in the Sados of Shvius. And all because of what? A financial difficult situation. So Rashi and Tosfos Dibra Maaseh Misharabu on the top of the page come to the same conclusion. And that is that Shvius Bizman Hazed Rabbanon, the entire sugya that we're learning about Shvius is the Rabbanon. So all the kashas that we asked, we started this sugya. Why did the Rabbanon have to passel the Sokre Shvius if they're violating a Doraisa? The answer is because Kedusha Shvius Bizman Hazeh is only the Rabbanon. But Rashi and Tosfos don't tell us exactly why Shvius Bizman Hazeh is the Rabbanon. And Rabbo said, what I'm about to tell you now is what we say, Dok v'tishkach, meaning put it in the classified information. It could be that today, in the state of Israel, Shvius is Doraisa. And I'll tell you why. We need what's called Rov Yoshvei Olel, which means that when the Jews converge on the land of Israel, most of the population of the Jewish population on the world alive at any particular moment in time lives in Eretz Yisrael. That's when Shvius is Doraisa. Clearly, at the time of the Chazal, that was not the case. And therefore, as a result of the years of Golus, Shvius became Derabbanan. Which, by the way, if you learn Shvius, you have to know how far the Chazal went with Shvius. I'll give you an example. There are lands that were conquered by Yoshua, that were not conquered by Ezra and Nehemiah, meaning the Olei Bavel. They were not settled, I should say, by the Olei Bavel. Those lands are not chayev in Shvius Doraisa. Do you follow? Maybe I should draw this on the board. Do we happen to have... Yes, we're in luck. Okay? You have here... Does anybody have a shmata I could use?
Where is it?
Oh, thank you. Here, let's create two circles. Okay, I'm giving you a crash course in Shvius here. We have a circle here, and then we have a circle here. These are the bounds of Eretz Yisrael, which are called Olei Mitzrayim. Meaning when the Jews got out of Egypt and they conquered the land, these were the larger boundaries of land that they conquered of the Shiva Amamin. However, that Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael is called Kitchel Ashait of a low Kitchel Asid level, meaning it's a temporary sanctification because it was a result of a military conquest. When that military conquest failed, in other words, when the Jews were sent out to Golos at the time of Nebuchadnezzar, time of the Bavliim, at that moment in time, the Kedusha of Shvius and other mitzvah Tlis Baris was Batel. But then, 70 years later, at the time of Ezra Nehemiah, a certain percentage of the Jewish people came back to Eretz Yisrael. That's called Aliyah Shnia. And that's called Kedusha Shnia. And they conquered a certain... They settled, I should say, in a certain very limited area. Again, maybe my circles are not, you know, are not to scale, but what I mean to say is that there were tremendous territories that were left out of the Olei Bavel, what we call, as that were conquered by the Olei Mitzrayim. On a Doraisa level, since the original Kedusha was L'shaita V'lo Kidshalos level, that means it was Batel with Churban,
we needed a new Kiddusha, a new Makadesh to sanctify the land of Israel at the time of Ezra Nechemi. So only those lands that were sanctified at the time of Ezra Nechemi of the Olei Bavel would now have, let's say, Shvi'is Doraisa. So it's unbelievable when you think that Rashi and Tosis here are learning in our sugya that the Kiddusha of Shvi'is and the Issa Schora and even the Issa of Zriya of working the land is all Drabbanah Bizman Hazeh. And that Issa Drabbanah is going to extend to include all the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael, even those parts of Eretz Yisrael that were conquered by Oli Mitzrayim but were not settled by the Oli Bavel. It's like one Drabbanah on the other. And the story doesn't even end here, because above here, somewhere to the north, is an area called Syria. And in that area, even at the time of David HaMelech, because David HaMelech was the one who went up to Aram Tzova and he conquered those lands, that was also Darabonon, because that wasn't included in the bounds of Eretz Yisrael. And that depends upon a sugya called Kibush Yochid, Lav Shmei Kibush, which means that David HaMelech made his own decision, so to speak, to go out to battle. And it was before that, before they had actually conquered all the lands of Eretz Yisrael, and therefore, so what I'm telling you now is that Shvi'is is like one Drabbanon and another Drabbanon and another Drabbanon, and that's how it goes. You know, it reminds me, because I'm learning in a different shiur, Basa B'Cholov. You know, how do you get Basa B'Cholov D'Oraisa? Nothing that we have in this entire volume called Yoridea Chelek Aleph has anything to do with Basa B'Cholov D'Oraisa. I mean, Basa B'Cholov D'Oraisa is probably one out of 1,000 cases that you're going to deal with in Yoridea, when you actually took milk and meat and cooked it together. But there's going to be one gzera on top of the other, chicken on top of basar, and then if two people sitting at the same table and they're eating cold, I mean, it's wild. You know, it just keeps going and going. And that's what Shvi'is is like. So getting back to Rashi and Tosfos, Shvi'is bizman hazeh d'rabbanan. So now the rabbanan make a takona of Shvi'is, and now we have a gzeras melech of Arnona. So the rabbanan have to make a decision: are they going to insist and push forward their takana with all the isurei shvi'is that are implicit, or are they going to say, you know what, adkan? Now we have to drop the ball on shvi'is. We got into a situation here in history where the Jewish people are going to be left penniless. You know, all the lands will be confiscated by the melech. And therefore, we're going to say that we're going to withhold our takana. We're going to limit our takana because of the gzera of the king. So this has to do with a principle called Heim Amru VeHeim Amru, which means that the Rabbanu, when they institute something, they have the rights to limit and restrict that rabbinic enactment. So, like, for example, the Gemara says in Pesachim that Bedikas Chametz is only Drabbanon, and even though the Torah doesn't trust a Katan, but we're going to rely on a Katan who testifies that his father did Bedika, because Hey Mamru Ve Hey Mamru. So the Rabbanon have total control to define the parameters and the scope of an Issa Drabbanon. And in this case, that Shvi'is is Drabbanon, Drabbanon would Masak in Shvi'is when the Torah would not recognize Shvi'is. They said that in the case where the Jews would suffer such a financial loss, they were martyred. However, the Piskei Arid goes as far as to say that even if Shvi'is is Doraisa, it would still be mutter to violate Shvi'is in order to pay the king's tax. Why? Because he says that im lo yimshaf, if they don't pay the king's tax, the punishment will go way beyond confiscating their property. So yamelch meinicham bebeis hasoar ulefamim hayumesim sham. So those who enjoyed, you know, there's a whole school today, I think, in Bar Ilan and other places where they love to study tshuva literature and get history, derive history from tshuva literature. This is a perfect example, just to get a picture of the sociology and the life of the Jew in his community historically, the pressures that he was under, according to Piskei Arid. that the reason why our Gemara allows violation of Shvi'is Da'oraisa, he says, for the sake of paying this tax, is because the consequence of paying the tax is that you might get thrown into jail, and that's where you would die. And this has a lot to do with the story about the Maharam Rutenberg. If you ever heard of him, he was the Rebbe of the Rush, and he died in jail. And in many cases, the Jewish people would gather together enormous sums of money to ransom someone, but in the case of Maharam Rutenberg, he refused to allow them to do so, and he actually died in jail. His body, it took years and years, more than a decade, until they finally were able to ransom his body for burial. So this was the sad state of the Jewish people at that time, and according to Piskei Ari, there's an element here of Pikuach Nefesh, which overrides Shvi'is Da'oraisa. But Ran has the following question. We have a principle called Kiddush Hashem, that if a guy forces you to violate the Torah, then you have to be willing to give up your life rather than violate the Torah. Again, that only applies when it's public, in the case of three cardinal sins, even in private, but in a case like Shvi'is, which is an Issa Doraisa, according to Piskei Ari, then we're talking about Bifarhesia. Bifarhesia, you have to be willing to give up your life rather than submit yourself to violate the Torah. Even the Gemara says, a regular losa says, it's not one of the big three. Now, how could it be that they were allowed to violate Shvi'is with an Avera b'farhesia, when the Torah says in a farhesia, when the guy forces you, Yeharig Val Yavar? Zokteran, Kemon Shamelech Osa Kein Lahana Osa, Velo Lahavir Es Hayudim Al Dosam, Al Din Torah, is Yavar V'al Yeharig. And he quotes Yerushalmi to support them. Abosai, did you hear that?
Yeah.
Jerry, you heard that? Can you repeat what the Ran just said? What was motivating the king?
His own personal interest, not the Jews.
Correct. He wasn't trying to get the Jews to violate the Torah. When do we say that for Hesse you have to give up your life for anything, any Avera? And your Harig Val Yavar, that's only when the king or whoever is pressuring you is interested in Lavuri al-Das, to see to it that you violate your Torah. That's called Gzera Shmad. Shmad means when they want to persecute the Jew religiously. What would be a perfect example? I think it's about a week ago or 2 weeks ago, whenever it was, I forget. Hanukkah. That's what the Yevanim were all about. That was religious persecution in public and Yehari Val Yavar. But here, the king is interested in fattening his treasury chest. That's not Lavur El Das, and therefore there's no din of Yeharig Val Yavar. Now, what interests me here, but that's just Berzon, is that the Ran quotes a Yerushalmi. I don't know why the Ran has to quote a Yerushalmi. The Gemara later on in this Masechta is explicit that the reason why Esther was allowed to have a relationship with Achashverosh is because he wasn't interested in having her violate her religion. How do I know that Achashverosh wasn't interested in having...
She didn't tell him.
He didn't even know she was Jewish. So the Gemara says in that case she was allowed to have a relationship with Achashverosh because it was it wasn't Lavuri al-Das, it was La'nos Atzmo Komachami. You can take a look, I don't have it here in my volume, on Daf Ayin Dalet Omid Beis, or maybe it's Ayin Hey Omid Beis, and you'll see it there. So I don't know why he has to stretch his arm out to the Yerushalmi. But now we have Tosus and Gid. And in my mind, this is the simplest answer to the question as to why the Chacham allowed Avoda in the case of Shvi'is for the sake of paying the Arnon. Says Tosus, there are two opinions in the Gemara Gittin Samach Beis about the following issue. Now, I'm going to ask someone in the audience to tell me a two-word phrase in Hebrew, which is not going to appear here in Tosfos and Gittin, that should automatically arise by association in your minds. Tosfos and Gittin says there are two opinions as to Yesh Kinyan Akum Lafkias Kedushas Shvi'is or ain kinyan akum lafkiya perishviya kedusha shviyas. How is sugya reflects the sheet of yesh kinyan akum? What does it mean? Let's say I would sell my land. I'm a Jew living in Eretz Yisrael, and I sell my land to a guy. The guy is now the owner of my land. Am I chayev in shviyas, or am I not chayev in shviyas? So if you hold yesh kinyan li akum lafkia, it means that the ownership over the land of the guy completely undermines the kedushas shviyas. And our sugya, says Tosfos Kitten here in Sanhedrin, reflects that opinion that maintains yesh kinyan akum. Which two word phrase did I have in mind before that should come to your mind? Nobody has it? I never know whether I think of you guys as too great of scholars than you really are, or the opposite. You know, I should give you more credit. But here it's called the Heter Mechira. Have you ever heard those two words? If you live in the state of Israel in this period of time, you must have heard of those words, Heter Mechira. Now, personally, I'll tell you why, in my family, we don't rely on the Heter Mechira. Not because we're so, you know, looking for chumras, but because of a tradition we have from our Rebbe. But I'll get to that in just a minute. So today, and this dates back to the time of the original Rav Kook, Rav Avram Yitzchak Cohen Kook, who was the chief rabbi of Palestine before the state, we allow the farmers to work during Shavuot. How can we allow that? And these are even religious farmers. So the answer is because we sell the land to the goyim. Now, what does it mean we sell the land to the goyim? This is a little bit strange. I don't know. Let's say in Kibbutz Lavi, for example, there are certain areas of the kibbutz where they don't do any malacha on shviyas; they leave it fallow. And there are other areas of the kibbutz which they actually work. So they accepted the Heter Mechira, but they still want to, you know, sort of present themselves as we also are fulfilling the law according to those who rejected Rav Kook, who rejected the Heter Mechira. So they're posev al shtei ha-se'ifim, as we would say. But the Heter Mechira, it doesn't mean that the Rabbanut is going to knock on the door of the mazkir of the kibbutz, you know, the secretary of the kibbutz in Lavi and every single kibbutz, and he's going to, and the Rabbanut is going to say, you know, let's sit down with, we'll call him Mohammed here, and we're going to have a shtar, you're going to sell kibbutz Lavi to Mohammed. But somehow, the state of Israel will sell all the karkos in Eretz Yisrael to the goyim. And is one shtar for all the fields in Israel. Somehow we're going to get the signatures of, I don't know exactly, it's very complicated. Now the reason why I personally don't rely on the Heter Shviyas, that's why, you know, people come to my house and they give me wine. You know, there's still wines that say Heter Shviyas on it. I never know what exactly to do with those wines. You know, I don't want to embarrass the person, say, please, take it back. But Rav Soloveitchik was of the opinion that you can't sell Eretz Yisrael. There's no such thing. The halacha doesn't recognize the sale of the land of Israel. What our Gemara is talking about, according to this sheet of Tosfos and Gittin, is that individual Jews were working for Goyim in Eretz Yisrael, but the Goyim actually were legally owners of that land. And therefore, says Tosfos, that if you hold like that opinion in Gittin, that yesh kinyan li'akum lafkia karkos mikdushasam l'gavi shviyas, therefore, the melech owned the land, and the Jews were sort of, how do you say chakira in English? You know, there's like, for example, you know that today this Keren Kayemet owns certain land. What's it called that we get 90? You know, we get 99 years.
A lease.
Okay, we'll use the word a lease. I think in Hebrew, I think it's called a chakira. Anyway, you get this long-term lease, but the technical owner of the land is the non-Jewish government, and therefore there's no kedusha shviyas according to that mandi yomer. Again, what's difficult is to know whether we paskin like that mandi yomer, that our sugya should be standing on the shoulders of that one opinion in the Gemara. In any event, we have now three different answers to the same question: how did the chachamim allow this to go on? and permit an Isa Doraisa of working the fields and Shvias simply because of the financial pressure of the Arnon of the king. And let's just review these three answers. The first answer is Heimamru veHeimamru, meaning Rashi Tos hold that Shvias Bizmanazeh is the Rabbanon, and therefore the Rabbanon said we're not going to impose the Isa Shvias here and force the Jews to take and suffer such a financial loss. We have the second answer that even if Shvias is Doraisa, but nevertheless it's a Pikuach Nefesh situation, it's a danger to the Jewish life because they'd be thrown into jail, and who knows if they'll rot in jail, Chas v'Shalom. And even though the Ran says there should be a Yehorig Val Yavar, but here it's not, he wasn't miscaving Lavuri Al Das, and therefore there's no Yehorig Val Yavar. And then we have the third answer of Tosus, that even if Kiddusha Shvius Bisman Hazeh would be the Raisa, but Yesh Kinyan Akum, if the land is owned by the guy, then there's no Shvius Doraisa, and this was a situation where the land was owned by a god. Now the next piece of Gemara, I would really like the Kohen in here to go out. They shouldn't be here for the next piece of Gemara, because they're not going to appreciate the next piece of Gemara. Rav Chiya Barznoni, Rav Shimon ben Yotzadok. So we have two great Tanoim, Rabbi Chiya, two great Amoraim, Rabbi Chiya and Rabbi Shimon, Havi Ka'azli Li Aber Shana. They were on the way to add another, or to decide whether we should add another month of Adar to the year. And they did it in Asya. Now, where is Asya? Asya is in Chutz Laretz. And we have halacha that Iber Shana, which we learned back on Daf Yud Aleph, requires a Beis Din in Eretz Yisrael. And we're going to assess the agricultural and the weather conditions and the seasons and so forth in Eretz Yisrael. Why would they go to Chutz Laretz to be Ma'abra the Shana? Well, the answer they give is that they weren't going to be Ma'abra the Shana in Asya, but there they would do the calculations. And the reason why they didn't want to do these Chishuvim, the Cheshbonos, and calculations in Eretz Yisrael is because there was something going on at that time in Eretz Yisrael, and there were pressures and religious persecutions, and this process of chishuv, of deciding whether there should be an Ibur Shana or not, had to be done clandestinely, so they went out to a place in Chutz Laretz. The Meiri has a radical approach here to this sugya. He claims that they actually went to Asya, to Chutz Laretz, to be Ma'abra the Shana. And even though we have a principle of Ein Ma'abra the Shana but Chutz Laretz, here it's different. Why? Because we're talking about a case of Loish Iru Chachomim Kamosom Ba'aretz. If the greatest scholars of the generation happen to be in Chutz Laretz, then the law is that you're allowed to do the Ibur Shana even in Chutz Laretz. Now we have another issue here, which I don't want to get into, but the Gemara establishes back in the first Perek of Sanhedrin that Ein Ra'abrim Es Shnas HaShviyitz, Es Shana B'Shan Shviyitz. On the seventh year, we don't do Ibur Shana. And this was obviously, as we'll see the story unfold, on the seventh year. But there is one man, the Yom, who says that Mutali Abris HaShana B'Shviyitz. In any event, they're packing their bags, they're on the way to Asya, and Pogabuhu Reish Lakish. So Reish Lakish, in this long story that we're going to learn with as many details, he is the protagonist. He's the main persona. Whether you like what he says or you don't like what he says. And that's going to be a tremendous friction. Itfil Badai, he decided to accompany these people, these great Amoraim. Omar, he declared, Ezel v'echse hechi avdi uvda. This is my chance to learn from these giants exactly whether or not we should add an extra month and we should be Ma'arba the Shana. Echse, I will go. Ezel, I will go. Echse, I will see. I will learn. Hechi avdi uvda. How does this go about happening? Chazi, he sees lahu gavra. As they're on their way, he sees a person. This is still in Eretz Yisrael. Dikar kariv, that he is plowing his field. Amalem, so Reish Lakish turns to Rav Chiya and Rav Shimon and says to them, Kohen v'choresh? He's a Kohen and he's violating Shvius and you say nothing? How can you let this go by? I mean, we have a mitzvah at least of Hokeach Tochiyach Samisecha, and he is none other than a Kohen, and he's violating the Issa Shvius. Amrulos, Reb Chiya and Reb Shimon respond to Reish Lakish, and they say, Yochel Lomar, it's possible that if we would accost him, if we would, you know, if we would encounter the Kohen and ask him what's going on, he would say to us, Agiston ani betocho. I am not plowing my own field. This field is owned by a guy. And once again, we'll activate the principle of the Gemara Gittin of Yesh Kinyan Li Akam Lafkia. So for the land in Eretz Yisrael is owned by a guy, there's no Issa Shvius. So he's going to tell you that he's an apprentice, he's working as a commissioned farmer on behalf of the owner of the field who's a guy. Now again, it's not clear that this was so, but the Chachamim said that that's probably what the Kohen will respond in order to, you know, out of embarrassment, he's going to present this situation, this description, in order that they shouldn't castigate him and maybe put him into cherem, you know, for violating the laws of Shvi'i. Suchazia, they're still on their way. Lahu Gavra, they see another person. Davi Kosach Becharmi, that he was pruning, that's called Kosach. Kerem is a vineyard, and this was during Perish Shvius. Now, Zomer, to prune, is what's called a tolda of Zorea. There are two ways that you can cause gidul, cause growth. One is by planting, and the other is by pruning something that's already planted, and it's already growing. So they see this fellow who's pruning his land during Shvius. Amar lehem, Reish Lakish says to Reb Chiya and Reb Shimon, Kohen. He looks like a Kohen. Now, how does a Kohen look? I mean, I looked at people, I never was able to figure out who's a Kohen or not. But somehow, what do you say?
Red hair.
Red hair, okay. I think that if a person gets angry, maybe he's a Kohen. The Gemara says a Kohen of Akzodim. But Rav Salvechi said that's not what the Gemara means at all. That's a classic misnomer, misunderstanding Gemara. Anyway, it's very hard to know if he's a Kohen. So I don't know how Reish Lakish, did he have a sign on his, you know, said that my name is Jack Kohen? I don't know. But if it's Zomer, and he was also pruning, Amru Lo, so Reish Lakish turns again to Reb Chiya and Reb Shimon, he says to them, what's going on? How are you allowing this Kohen to violate the laws of Shvius? And they tell him, Yochel Lomar, Lakel Beis Habada Nitzarech. Then I'm not really violating the laws of Shvius, because if you prune, what you do is you cut off branches. And those branches can be used in a Beis Chabad. You know, for those who like archaeology, you can go out and see what a Beis Chabad looked like, you know, centuries and centuries ago. But basically, what happens is when you crush the olives, then what you need is a certain equal, meaning you need a certain piece of wood that would prevent the olives from getting smashed. So he's not doing anything productive. He's only trying to avoid a loss. So I see it's getting late, so I'm just going to come back tomorrow to this question of what equal Beis Chabad is as far as Shvius. Amar lehem. So Reish Lakish says to them, Alev Yodea, the truth in the heart is im li'akel, im la'akalkulis. This is a play on words. La'akalkulis means that he wants to violate the Torah, but it's the same three letters in the Shoresh as la'akel beis abad. So la'akel beis abad is, you know, for the olive press, that's allowed. But the other use of the word akel is to violate the Torah law. And basically what Reish Lakish is saying is that I know that this is an outright, deliberate violation of the laws of Shvius. Now, what's going to ensue tomorrow is a tremendous, in Hebrew we call it a pulmus, how do you say in English, a big controversy, because the Gemara is going to accuse Reish Lakish of holding the Kohanim as a member group of the nation of Israel that were Chashurim al Shvius, that the Kohanim would violate the laws of Shvius. And that's why Reish Lakish, whenever he saw someone violating the laws of Shvius, he called him a Kohen. He assumed he was a Kohen. And the Gemara is going to get very upset about, you know, with this categorization of the Kohenim as being Chashudim.
Racist.
al ha al hashvi. So Mirtz Hashem, we'll pick this up tomorrow. And if anyone's interested in learning a little bit at the brachos, you can stick around. We'll start in about, let's say, 2 or 3 minutes. Okay, then.